I want to thank the Bayit for once again co-sponsoring this this legal ethics session. It's the first of 2017 on cognitive bias and the client, or it's not what you think, defeating cognitive bias, as I called it, I think, on the flyers and on the source sheet. This is another of the legal ethics sessions provided by my Beit Midrash, the Yeshiva University Tzara Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. Part of our mission is trying to provide guidance on and to talk about the issues of Torah and Halacha, Jewish law, that intersect with our professional lives. The session is also sponsored by Rachel and Jeffrey Silver in honor of the 65th wedding anniversary of Label and Leona Silver. Kainir B'mazel Tov. Okay, so actually, I should thank Jeffrey as well for putting me up to this topic. I never would have dawned. Jeffrey, where are you? Yeah, there he is. It never would have dawned on me to talk about this. And having now done the research, I'm fascinated by it, and I feel like it's a very important topic, not just for lawyers to be aware of, but anybody, frankly, to be aware of. There's a lot involved here. You can see on the sheets. There's a lot of material. Hopefully going to get through all of it. I start with source number one as a bit of an introduction. This comes from a paper which you see referenced, Don't Believe Everything You Think. All of the papers that I refer to here are available online. If you Google the title, you'll be able to find the papers themselves and to read them in full. This fellow, Ian Weinstein, in the case at hand, is talking about a client who was caught in a drug deal, and there were tapes of him talking about the deal. They caught him on site with bricks of cocaine. And this is part of his conversation that he has with Mr. Worth, the invented client in the story. Quote, "They took a bag from me, but this paper says it was a box." Mr. Worth repeated, "They have no case against me. No jury will send me away when the prosecutor is lying and saying the drugs were in a paper bag. A paper bag is not a box." Now, he says, I've changed the details of the case so that it'll be, you can't trace it to the original, but he says he's being faithful to what actually happened with the client, in the sense that it's that kind of a detail that the client is seizing upon and saying, I'm fine, because they say they got a box for me, but in fact, the drugs were in a paper bag. So he responds, "I will argue that," I assured him again, "but what do you think the prosecutor will say about the bag or box business? Like I said before, I think the agent will just say it was a mistake on the complaint. The prosecutor will say that the drugs inside are what matters. I don't think the jury will focus the whole case on that." "But it was a bag," he insisted. "I hear you," I replied, nodding. You ever see anything like that with a client? Where they seize on some kind of an irrelevant detail and think that that's going to make the case for them. Called traffic court, right. That's right. They described my car wrong on the ticket, and therefore I'm going to be fine. So what Ian Weinstein points out here, what's going to become clear, I expect, in the next 90 minutes, is that this is actually part of a broad phenomenon called cognitive bias, which has been developed by psychologists and others in over the past decades. And it affects, really, the decisions we make in every field, in law, certainly. So there are certain rules of professional conduct that are going to be relevant here, because what we're going to talk about is recognizing the bias of the client, as well as whether the lawyer is entitled to make use of cognitive bias, principles of cognitive bias, in dealing with a client for the client's best interest, as well as whether you're allowed to take advantage of it in negotiating with the other side or in arguing in front of a jury. Could you intentionally use these principles for your own benefit? So there are a few rules of professional conduct that we should lay out at the outset. In source number 2, I bring you rule 3.2-1 as well as -2 as well as -9. First, a lawyer has a duty to provide courteous, thorough, and prompt service to clients. The quality of service required of a lawyer is service that is competent, timely, conscientious, diligent, efficient, and civil. Continuing, when advising clients, a lawyer shall be honest and candid. Honest and candid means you have to be straightforward, which right off the bat sounds like I'm not allowed to take advantage of ways in which a client's thinking may be biased, but we'll come back to that. When a client's ability to make decisions is impaired because of minority, mental disability, or for some other reason, the lawyer shall, as far as reasonably possible, maintain a normal lawyer and client relationship. So the commentary goes on to say on this, if the client needs help, if the client has some kind of disability, if the client is not able to properly perceive what is going on and make the proper decisions, then there may be a need to actually get the client a formal representative. And I stress that for reasons that we're going to have to come back to in a bit. But one last rule in source number 3. When acting as an advocate, a lawyer shall represent the client resolutely and honorably within the limits of the law while treating the tribunal with candor, fairness, courtesy, and respect. And in the commentary we find out, in adversarial proceedings, the lawyer has a duty to the client to raise fearlessly every issue, advance every argument, and ask every question, however distasteful, that the lawyer thinks will help the client's case, and to endeavor to obtain for the client the benefit of every remedy and defense authorized by law. Stopping there for a moment. If one of our questions is whether I, as a lawyer, am entitled to use the principles of cognitive bias to lead the jury or to lead the judge or to lead the other party in a settlement to in a certain direction, what do you think you would, what do you think are the limits on what I can do based on the rule and the commentary we just stated in number 3? Would source number 3 allow me to try to say things or do things that will lead the jury, that will lead the other side in a settlement where I want them to go?
Well, you're still too macro, but all I can think of is the glove doesn't fit, you must quit.
Meaning? I remember the case.
I understand. Meaning? You could say it's an irrelevancy, so the glove is shrunk up after 5 years of being in the whatever, and yet there's those who think that got them off. So is it an irrelevancy, or is it something they make? And you don't know who that jury is. Maybe it's just a judge. If it's just a jury, you don't know which jury you picked out there. That might mean something to. Maybe right. You've got it figured out that that bag job may be what that guy right over there hung up the jury.
Okay. So Reed suggests that this is normal practice to try to influence. Yes.
So I'd like you to just maybe define it a little more narrowly, and that is whether the cognitive dissonance is due to mental impairment on the part of a client, where they're delusional, they might not have be able to take responsibility for what they're doing, in which case you have a certain set of obligations towards that client, as you mentioned, because of the mental health issues or impairment, versus a client who just likes to get confused about the facts, and whether or not a lawyer is allowed to rely upon that so-called confusion.
Right.
Some might call it dishonesty of a client.
Good. So we do need to narrow things down a bit, because there is cognitive bias that takes place with people who are perfectly healthy, intelligent, and functional, and then there is cognitive bias that takes place because somebody has a particular impairment. I'm going to give an example that we're going to get to a little bit later. Something called priming. Anyone ever hear of priming? In priming, or anchoring as it's also called, if you mention a large number to somebody, it is apt to bias them towards large numbers. I'll give you an example that will actually. Maybe I'll just jump to the example on the sheet.
16 or 17.
I'm sorry. Well, it's not 16. The now the case that I want. I'm going to say it outside of the text rather than hunt for it. No, that's all right. I'm gonna say it outside of the text.
Seven.
People are just going to call out numbers. Yes, number 7 it is. Thank you. We have a winner.
Go lower. 6.
Right. There we go. The anchoring or priming effect, is blamed for all kinds of irrational impacts on thinking. For example, participants in a wine auction who are asked to write down the last two digits of their social security numbers before bidding were found to bid higher numbers if the social security numbers were higher. Okay? Your social security number ended in 95. You were more apt to bid higher for the wine than if your social security number ended in 32. There's no relationship whatsoever between your social security number and what you're going to bid on the wine. They weren't told that there was any connection. They were told to write this down like as an identifier or something on your sheet. And yet, that was enough to produce a detectable result in the bids from people. So that's a case that I'm talking about. I'm in some kind of a negotiation, and I can find a way to get them to think of a large number before we're actually going to deal with the settlement. Is that legitimate? Am I allowed to do that ethically, knowing that I am influencing their thinking?
I think you're obligated.
Sarit says already, he's already established that you're obligated to do that. We're going to have to talk about this more. But in order to get there, we need to talk about what cognitive bias is and why it works. So what I'm doing here is going to be an overarching view of types of cognitive bias. And I'll give a little bit of a biological explanation for how it works. However, one book that I found very, very helpful in introducing this and actually discusses a lot of the biological basis for it, and it gives a much more full treatment, is the book Thinking Fast and Slow, which you see referenced in number 4, by Professor Daniel Kahneman. Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky did a lot of the groundbreaking work on this. And I highly recommend it. It's a very readable book. And aside from the fact that Kahneman, I think, and Tversky won the Nobel Prize for... No, just Kahneman? Won the... Tversky died beforehand. Okay. So Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in economics for the influence of cognitive bias on the decisions that that people make. So I highly recommend reading it. But Kahneman outlines something which he calls System 1... and System 2. There's two different ways in which our minds function. System 1 is superficial. System 2 is deep and analytic. And the argument essentially is that we would prefer, not consciously, subconsciously, we would prefer to use System 1 all the time. To be superficial in the way that we approach the world, to make snap judgments, not to think deeply, and just go with our gut, go with our intuition, with our instinct. However, sometimes something comes to our attention which requires that we analyze more deeply, and then we have to bring System 2 to bear. However, our default is System 1, and our minds come up with what are called heuristics, to try to come up with shortcuts for solving problems so that we could use System 1. A heuristic is a system for solving a problem in an approximate way rather than in a very precise way that can be done easily. So rather than have to think things through carefully, I can just come up with a snap judgment for something and move on. So an example of that is... You see a face, you can tell right away whether this person is angry at you or not. You hear a voice on the phone, you can tell right away what kind of emotion is behind the voice. You can't do it 100%. If you write down your predictions and then match them up with reality, you'll have a very high percentage of correct answers, enough to save your life, so to speak. Enough that you'll generally be okay going with those predictions. It's only if you hear something that doesn't match your judgment, or you see something that doesn't match your judgment, that you'll then think more deeply and revisit it. Why do we prefer System 1? So take a look at source number 4, Professor Kahneman's observation. A series of surprising experiments by psychologist Roy Baumeister and his colleagues has shown conclusively that all variants of voluntary effort, cognitive, emotional, or physical, draw at least partly on a shared pool of mental energy. In other words, it saps your energy to think. Their experiments involve successive rather than simultaneous tasks, and he goes on. The most surprising discovery made by Baumeister's group shows, as he puts it, that the idea of mental energy is more than a mere metaphor. The nervous system consumes more glucose than most other parts of the body. An effortful mental activity appears to be especially expensive in the currency of glucose. When you are actively involved in difficult cognitive reasoning or engaged in a task that requires self-control, your blood glucose level drops. Thinking saps our energy. There was a remarkable study that that Kahneman cited. It was done in Israel among the judges. Anyone familiar with this study? This is a great study. They actually studied the decisions by judges based on how long it had been since they ate. You saw this. And they found an impact on it based on how long it had been since they ate. As their blood sugar level drops, they're more apt to go with system one and not with system two. Not to analyze more deeply, but to make a snap judgment. So you talk about how it's possible to influence your client or somebody on the other side, depriving them of food is actually going to have an effect. Now, keep in mind, with all of these issues and all of these cases that we're going to discuss, we're also going to have to discuss how you defeat it. Meaning, it's not as though you are stuck as a function of System 1 and that there's no way to break out of System 1. We'll talk about that. But these are detected, tried, and tested biases that we're actually familiar with. So the brain prefers not to think deeply and instead go with this kind of shorthand view of the world, which can lead to incorrect conclusions. And those are what we call cognitive biases. A bias in the way one thinks based on this preference for System 1. So let's go through some common cognitive biases and how they affect judges, juries, and clients. Take a look at source number 5 from a paper on Do Attorneys Do Their Clients Justice? Litigants do not always, or perhaps even typically, make decisions as the rational actors contemplated by the basic economic model of suit and settlement. Kropotkin and Guthrie, I didn't actually check to find out whether Russell Kropotkin is related to Evan Kropotkin here. I have to assume he is. He's a researcher whose name comes up quite a bit in this. Kropotkin and Guthrie, as well as several others who you see listed here, and then you jump to the parentheses, say, cognitive psychology and experimental economics have found a smorgasbord of cognitive errors which collectively falsify most of the axioms of rational choice theory. In other words, this is a common phenomenon. This is not something that happens, on rare occasion. This actually is something that can be observed in many, many cases. So, case number one that we're going to look at is the discussion of anchoring / priming. Source number 6. I love this study. This is great. If you're wondering, like, what can you do with cognitive bias, take a look at this. In one early study of anchoring, the idea of anchoring is that you say something to an individual that subconsciously sets them in a particular direction, thinking along certain lines. Priming is the same thing. The anchoring and priming are two terms that are used for the same phenomenon. In one early study of anchoring, professors Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman asked participants to estimate the percentage of African countries in the United Nations. Before asking for this estimate, they informed the participants that the number was either higher or lower than a numerical value identified by the spin of a wheel of fortune. So, we're going to give you a random number, and then after that, you're going to tell us the percentage of African nations in the UN. Tversky and Kahneman had secretly rigged this wheel of fortune to stop either on 10 or 65. When the wheel landed on 10, participants provided a median estimate of 25%. When the wheel landed on 65, participants provided a median estimate of 45%. So in other words, you spun the wheel of fortune. It came out on 10. They told you, okay, it's higher than 10. You were likely to guess 25. You spun the wheel of fortune. Came out on 65. They told you it's lower than 65. You were apt to answer 45. Even though you didn't know the thing had been rigged, you had no idea that they were giving you any sort of bound, you know, to this. Even though the initial values were clearly irrelevant to the correct answer, the initial values had a pronounced impact on the participants' responses. So this idea, and number seven, I gave you another example of it, the Social Security number example. By the way, it's not only about hearing numbers. Another example that Rabbi Feldman, my friend in number seven, brings, also a very worthwhile book. I'm going to digress for a moment, actually, to explain what this book is, because it's very worthwhile. He brings an unusual argument regarding the Jewish law of Lashon Hara, the law that prohibits speaking negatively about others. Usually, when we talk about speaking negatively about others and why Judaism prohibits it, we say it's because you spread slander about other people, you spread negative statements about other people. But he notes it's more than that. You create certain biases in people with negative things you say, even if they don't believe what you're saying. You create a negative sort of an atmosphere through the cognitive biases. And that's in a whole other element of the prohibition against Lashon Hara. It's a very worthwhile book, in the one that I referenced in number seven. But one of the cases that he brings involves people who were asked to assess whether somebody was a cold person or a warm person. And this is going to sound bizarre to you, but they were given a cup of warm coffee to hold or a cup of iced tea to hold beforehand. And you guessed it. People who were holding warm coffee were more apt to describe the person in warm terms than people who were holding iced tea. Strange, but true. So there actually are concerns like this about anchoring and priming in Jewish law as well. Take a look at source number 8, where I bring you one example about the way that litigants dress when they come to court. Right? I know, of course, about lawyers' robes here in Canada, but this is stated regarding the way litigants dress when they come to a Jewish court. How do we know? I brought you the Hebrew for authenticity, so you can see the original, but I'm going to read out the English in the interest of time. How do we know that where two litigants come for judgment, one wearing rags and the other wearing a 100 manek coat, a very expensive coat, we say to him, dress as he does or dress him like yourself? You tell the one who's wearing the expensive coat, either dress him up like you or you have to wear what he's wearing. The Torah teaches, distance yourself from falsehood. You have to be careful not to end up feeding into a lie by creating an impression that you're an upstanding citizen and the other fellow is not. How do we know that a judge shall not hear the words of a litigant before the other litigant arrives? The Torah teaches, distance yourself from falsehood. You can't allow yourself to be primed by hearing one person's side before the other. How do we know that a litigant shall not sample his words with the judge before the other litigant comes? The Torah teaches, distance yourself from falsehood. There is a concern about potential bias. To give a case of this involving judges in court, take a look at number 9, called Inside the Judicial Mind. They did a survey in the U.S. with federal magistrates who were at a conference. And they ended up surveying most of the pool of federal magistrates in the U.S. at the time that they did this study. Suppose that you are presiding over a personal injury lawsuit that is in federal court based on diversity jurisdiction. The defendant is a major company in the package delivery business. The plaintiff was badly injured after being struck by one of the defendant's trucks when its brakes failed at a traffic light. Subsequent investigations reveal that the braking system on the truck was faulty. The truck had not been properly maintained by the defendant. So you have a defendant who was stuck by the truck. There was some element of negligence involved. The plaintiff was hospitalized for several months, has been in a wheelchair ever since, unable to use his legs. He had been earning a good living as a freelance electrician and had built up a steady base of loyal customers. The plaintiff has requested damages for lost wages, hospitalization, and pain and suffering, but has not specified an amount. Both parties have waived their rights to a jury trial. Okay, so those are your facts. We randomly assign the judges to either a no-anchor condition or an anchor condition. We provided judges in the no-anchor group with a paragraph above that gave the details and asked them, how much would you award the plaintiff in compensatory damages? That's if you're in the no-anchor group. It's just, what would you award? We provided the judges in the anchor group with the same information, but in addition, we informed them that, quote, the defendant has moved for dismissal of the case, arguing it doesn't meet the jurisdictional minimum for a diversity case of $75,000. We tell them that the defendant has said it doesn't meet the threshold. It has to be $75,000. It isn't even $75,000. We ask these judges to rule on the motion, and then ask them, if you deny the motion, how much would you award the plaintiff in compensatory damages? Because the plaintiff clearly had incurred damages greater than $75,000, the motion was meritless. So they should reject the $75,000 argument, and then move on. The results showed that ruling on the motion had a large effect on damage awards. The 66 judges in the no-anchor condition, who knew nothing about any $75,000 thing, indicated they would award plaintiff an average of $1.25 million, while the 50 judges in the anchor condition awarded an average of $882,000. They award that much less just because somebody whispered in their ear that it was less than $75,000, even though they rejected the $75,000 argument. That's the kind of impact that we're talking about with anchoring slash priming. Another example, hindsight bias. This one is probably more familiar to people. The idea that looking back, you know that certain things should, that you know that, let's say after a flood, you know that people should have protected themselves against the possibility of a flood. You're more apt to think that they were negligent for not protecting themselves against the possibility of a flood. That's the concept of hindsight bias. Knowing what I know now, people should have made a decision in this direction beforehand. If you take a look at source number 10, an example of this, from that paper, Inside the Judicial Mind, where they surveyed the judges, several studies have demonstrated that the hindsight bias influences judgments of legal liability. Kim Kamen and Jeffrey Rachlinsky, for example, compared foresight decisions regarding whether to take a precaution against flooding with comparable hindsight evaluations of whether the failure to take this precaution was negligent. Meaning, they instructed participants judging in foresight to recommend the precaution if they believe the flood was more than 10% likely to occur in any given year. Okay? If it's more than 10% likely, then you're supposed to, then you are supposed to take precautions, get insurance, whatever it is, based on a cost-benefit comparison of the precaution and the damage the flood would likely cause. The researchers told the participants judging in hindsight that the precaution had not been taken and a flood causing $1 million in damage had occurred, and they instructed the participants to find the defendant liable for the flood if the likelihood of the flood from the perspective of the defendant was greater than 10% in any given year. You follow? So they say to one group, you're predicting, and you're saying that it would be negligent not to pursue this if the likelihood is greater than 10%. The other group was told a flood already happened, with a likelihood in advance of 10% that there would be such a flood. And the question then is, are they negligent for not having gotten the insurance? Both sets of participants reviewed identical information about the likelihood of a flood. They were both told it was 10%. However, they reached different conclusions about appropriate defendant behavior. Those who were not told that a flood actually took place, they're predicting it beforehand. Only 24% of them thought that that they should have taken the precaution. Those who were told the flood had actually taken place, 57% thought that it was negligent. Hindsight bias for you. Reminiscent of the story that occurs in the Chumash, the story involving the Jews in the wilderness who complained about Moshe, bringing them into the wilderness as though Moshe knew they weren't going to have food or they weren't going to have water. Or Reuven, if you remember the story of the sale of Joseph, right? Reuven says to his brothers when they're down in Egypt, why didn't you listen to me when our brother was suffering and I told you that we shouldn't harm him? Look at what's happening to us now. As though any of them would have known beforehand what was coming down the line. So that's another type of a potential bias, hindsight bias. A big one that I think you're probably familiar with is confirmation bias. Anyone familiar with confirmation bias? Yes. What is confirmation bias? anyone provide an explanation of confirmation bias? Yeah?
You seem to accept facts that prove what you believe already.
Bingo. Confirmation bias is the idea of, excuse me, the idea of accepting that which supports my point of view. And in a set of facts that I hear, I'm going to cherry pick the ones that support my perspective, and those are the ones that I'm going to run with. It comes up all the time in life. It comes up all the time in Torah itself. An example of it from Jewish law, take a look at source number 11. Regarding Lashon Hara, speaking slanderously about others, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, the Chafetz Chaim, writes, you are not allowed to praise somebody in front of his enemies. That's considered harmful speech. Why? Because the result is going to be that the enemy who hears you say this is going to find reason to reject what you've said and to try to spin it in another light to confirm what he already believes. He already believes this is a bad person. When you tell him this is a good guy, all he's going to do is try to spin it. He's good to you because X. Or what he did wasn't really good, it was self-interest. And so on. If you take a look at source number 12, we find it in terms of Jewish law regarding trials. If one of the witnesses in a trial, a witness against a defendant in a capital case, afterwards turns around and says, I have an argument on behalf of the defendant, even if his argument is on behalf of, he wants to help the defendant, we don't listen to him because we are concerned that the argument that the witness gives is going to turn into an attempt to support the testimony that he gave. He isn't going to want to say anything that's going to undermine his testimony. We're concerned about confirmation bias. Take a look at number 13, please, and you'll see it in the context of a jury. In three studies, participants read a case file and were subsequently instructed to select additional police investigations. So they heard about a particular alleged crime, and then they were supposed to choose what the police should do to investigate. Some of these additional endeavors were guilt-confirming. We're going to investigate in order to show the defendant is guilty. Whereas others were disconfirming to show he's not guilty. Results suggest that additional investigation search was guided by an initial assessment of the suspect's guilt. Meaning, if they thought that he was already guilty, that influenced the way that they chose the additional investigation. Furthermore, participants' tendency to select incriminating investigations increased with increased crime severity and with the strength of the evidence present in the case file. The worse the crime involved, the more likely they were to look for guilt. Finally, and the more likely, the stronger the evidence was they were presented with as well. Finally, the selection of incriminating investigations was associated with conviction rates. However, in general, participants did not favor incriminating endeavors. In general, they didn't. However, if you read a case file that made you think the person was guilty, you were more apt to choose a further investigation that would demonstrate the guilt of the defendant. A similar bias, along the lines of the confirmation bias, is called the halo effect. Halo effect is an old idea. Anybody want to venture an explanation of halo effect?
I'm guessing that you have a preconceived or there's a notion this is a good person, and so therefore you.
Bingo. Exactly. Halo, like the image of an angel with a halo, that's what we're talking about. The halo effect is a cognitive bias in which the observer's overall impression of a person or company or brand or whatever it is influences the way they feel in irrelevant properties of the individual, the brand, whatever it is. So, for example, I meet somebody on a job interview. I like them. They make a good impression. I forget to ask them about their experience in whatever the job actually is. Okay, the job requires that they be timely, that they be punctual. I forget to ask them anything about it or to observe whether they showed up on time for the interview or not. But afterwards, if I felt good about them in the interview, if someone asks me, are they punctual? I am more apt to say yes. Because I formed a positive impression of them that colors the way that I view them in general. This is something we also find within the way Judaism approaches trials. Take a look at source number 14 from the Code of Jewish Law. One may not judge a friend. A judge is not allowed to be a judge for a friend. Even if he's not what's called a shushvin, which was a technical term in Talmudic times for a very close friend, even if he's not your closest friend. And you're not allowed to judge also somebody you hate. Even if he's not an enemy, he doesn't seek to harm him. The litigants must be equal in the eyes and hearts of the judges. The concern is not only an overt, he's my friend, I want to help him type of a situation, but that the judge is going to be biased towards this person. We find it as well in source number 15, in which we are told that if the judges in a capital case rule on their initial vote unanimously to convict the defendant, we free him. Okay? At a baseball game, the center fielder pulls out a gun and shoots the shortstop. Thousands of people saw what happened. There's no debate. The case comes before the judges. The judges vote, hands down, 23-0. There's 23 judges on a capital case in Jewish law to convict. The rule is we throw out the case. Why? Because of concern, as the Talmud itself states in source number 15, because once they've had this kind of a vote, they're never going to see any argument on his behalf. And we can't accept that. There always has to be a way to argue on his behalf. And what you have here is this kind of a bias. In this case, it's the devil effect, not the halo effect. Everybody has already seen him negatively. I gave you one more set of examples of this in source number 16, where the Talmud talks about what's called a verbal bribe. And it gives sources, it gives stories in which various sages disqualified themselves from judging cases for people who had done them some very small favor. Somebody extends his hand to a judge when the judge is crossing a river. Somebody removes a feather from the head of a judge, and that is enough to bias him. It's not about this being a bribe. That's why we disqualify the judge. But it impacts the way the judge looks at the litigant. Right? Imagine you're going into court, you hold the door open for the judge, and that's already considered sufficient to bias the judge. That's what we're talking about here with this halo effect. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you're going to get to a point where the way the halachic system works, the dayanim, are the prosecutor and the defense. They're the ones asking the questions.
Correct.
In our system, in the common law, the basic idea is you have two comparable, competent advocates.
Yeah.
Both taking different sides, and the truth will come forward. How relevant is one system to the other with respect to acting honorably?
Right. So, you bet. The difference between the systems matters, and we'll have to see it. But on a very basic level, the judge, even though the judge is not, as you note, on either side, not arguing for either side, the judge is still quite vulnerable to a bias in terms of applying the law to whatever the findings are out of the cross-examinations and demonstrations of evidence and so on.
And if we apply that to advocates,
yeah,
and a guide to our activity,
yeah,
how does that apply?
So that's where we're going to have to go. I'm spending a lot of time on the biases themselves because I feel, well, for two reasons. Number one, I think it's good for you to know about them because they're useful. If you're allowed to use them, they're good for you to know about. But number two, because I think that it takes a lot of convincing for people to really get what we're talking about and the level on which this operates. And so that's another reason to walk through a lot of this. But take a look at number 17. Here's an example of application of this halo effect. The physical attractiveness of a criminal defendant, either attractive, unattractive, or no information, and the nature of the crime, whether it's related to attractiveness or not, were varied in a factorial design. After reading one of the case accounts, subject sentenced the defendant to a term of imprisonment. So you read a case involving a crime that may or may not be connected to attractiveness, depending on the case at hand, and had a description of whether the defendant was attractive or not. An interaction was predicted. When the crime was unrelated to attractiveness, so it's burglary. We assume that burglars are not naturally either attractive or unattractive. I didn't actually investigate this. This is their assumption. Subjects would assign more lenient sentences to the attractive defendant than to the unattractive defendant. When the offense was attractiveness related, such as swindling somebody, so you'd think that somebody who's attractive is more able to swindle somebody, the attractive defendant would receive harsher treatment. The results confirmed the predictions, thereby supporting a cognitive explanation for the relationship between the physical attractiveness of defendants and the nature of the judgments made against them. All right. I'll move a little bit faster in terms of some of these biases. There's another one called the egocentric bias. The egocentric bias says that others are going to see me and my actions in the way that I perceive them. In other words, I can justify what I am doing, and other people are apt to see it the way that I see it and take my side in this. I gave an example of it in number 20. That same fellow we talked about in the beginning with the bag and the box. So it's the same story. The problem with egocentric bias is our tendency to think many of our common, ordinary skills and experiences are exceptional. And now he talks about this fellow, Mr. Worth, who had the drugs. I had replied, I'm not sure the jury will see it that way, but there's still a lot we don't know about the evidence. I know, he responded, smiling, but I know myself. People like me. No jury will convict me. They don't convict people they like, do they? And he goes through trying to explain that it isn't so simple. But the client actually believes this. He believes that he will not be convicted because generally people like him. Another big example is framing bias. There's a bias towards avoiding loss as opposed to gaining something new. In other words, let me state it a little bit differently. If I perceive a settlement as a loss for me, I am more apt to do whatever I can to avoid that result. If I view a settlement as a gain, I am more apt to be conservative and not to risk losing whatever small gain I have achieved. You follow what I'm saying? I am more apt, if my lawyer tells me that I'm coming out ahead on this deal, I'm more apt to try to preserve whatever it is and be conservative and not try to push. If my lawyer tells me, this is a bad deal, you're going to lose by this, I am more apt to take risks in order to avoid that eventuality. It's called a framing bias. It's the way that you frame it. Do you frame it as a positive, as a gain, or do you frame it as a negative, as being harmed? I saw a fascinating paper which argued that this is actually the basis for a principle in law, which you find in Jewish law as well. The principle in Jewish law is Hamotzi mechavero alav haraya, which means, anybody know? I know some people here do know. What's the principle? Right. The burden of proof is on the person who wants to take something away from somebody else. What's the reason behind that principle? What's the reason?
There's a belief that whoever has it most likely deserves it.
Right, how does it go? Possession is
nine-tenths
of the law. Right? The idea is whoever has it is by default the person who will continue to have it unless somebody can prove otherwise. What if the person who has it only has it by dumb luck? Why should he have the right to hold on to it?
Because that's what judges decide.
No, but why? Where's the logic?
Someone has to have the burden.
It's true. Someone has to have the burden. Unless you want to say, we hold it in escrow. We take it away and we say, hold it in escrow until you can prove it. So the argument is made and it's brought in number 21, that it's based on the framing bias. We consider it worse to take something away from somebody than to give something to somebody. We consider it a harsher thing to do, to remove something from somebody's possession, and therefore we'll say he gets to keep it unless someone else can prove that he has a right to it. And this comes up in dealing with clients, I think, in obvious ways. I'm not going to go through the example. I brought it for you in number 22 for those who want to see it. Another example, and this is the last that we're going to go through, is representative bias. People think of conspicuous events as more likely to recur. Right? How many different times have you heard from people that it's more dangerous to drive a car than it is to fly in an airplane? But you know that people just naturally believe that planes crash more often than cars because that's what they hear about. They hear about plane crashes. It makes all the headlines. It's in the news. And therefore, that's the assumption that people make. It's what's called representative bias. I think that conspicuous events are more likely to recur. So what can you do to mitigate these things? So the first point is that go back to the point that Kahneman made about System 1 and System 2. System 1 thinking is the default. But it's not, you're not guaranteed that it's always going to be there. You can choose to invoke System 2. You can make a decision to say, I am going to think carefully about this, and so divest yourself of a lot of the biases. That's, I think, a very important point. Number two, recognize the way that System 1 works. If System 1's point is to say, things are generally very good right now, everything is fine, I'm not in any danger, and therefore I can continue to interact with my world based on the approximations of System 1, then it's important to not let yourself get lulled into a sense of security. If you're lulled into a sense of security, if someone puts you in a good mood, you're apt to use System 1. You have to be suspicious and say, I'm not safe. There's actually a lot of the work on this, and in the Kahneman book he goes into this in depth, but a lot of the work on this shows that when people get caught up in a good mood, if someone gets you into a good mood, you're much more apt to accept the things that they say. So that's another factor within this. You can also deal with particular biases in particular ways. Those are overarching. But for example, egocentric bias. He believes that he's special. Your client believes he's special and no jury is going to convict him. Probe why he believes he's special. Show the cases in which he wasn't special and he didn't gain an advantage by it, to get him to come to a different conclusion about his situation. Or, if he has representative bias, he believes that he's going to get off because he heard about a case in which somebody got off. So, find a better baseline of facts. Try to get the client to pursue more reasonable thinking. But at the end of the day, it's actually very hard to fully eliminate these biases. Take a look at number 23 from Feldman's book, False Facts and True Rumors. Attempting to correct for these biases, while a necessary first step, is only helpful to a point. Another frailty of the human psyche is the lack of awareness as to when these biases are present, even those that are theoretically known. Our awareness is itself blinded by bias, known appropriately as bias. In the words of Dr. Robert A. Burton, our mental limitations prevent us from accepting our mental limitations. So we can try to work on this, but you have to know that you're still vulnerable to it. And in source number 24, we find out that it's not only lay people who are vulnerable to this, but the lawyers as well, the experts as well, are also subject to this. Korotkin and Guthrie, in source 24, admit that experts generally are as prone to cognitive biases as lay people are. However, they counter those findings with an argument that the analytical skills of lawyers combined with their legal training might lead them, quote, to analyze legal conflicts carefully and unemotionally rather than to react to them viscerally. Perhaps, then, lawyers approach decisions from a different perspective than most other people, or are better able to learn from their experiences than other professionals, or both. So, it's possible that the lawyer will do better, but the lawyer has to be on guard for it. So, all of this, what we've done in the last 45 minutes, has been to set the table in terms of the discussion of cognitive biases. We've seen that there are a whole range of biases that have been identified, and there are many, many more than the ones that I went into. We could be here all day just discussing different kinds of biases and sources for them. We've seen that they are reflected not only in the psychological literature, but in many of the rules that have been established for court procedure in Jewish law, and I expect in secular law as well. But now we have to get to our two questions. Number one, is it okay to take advantage of bias when addressing a client? So let me give you a case. You have a client who is charged with drug dealing. I was probably primed for that by the Worth case that we saw. Client is charged with drug dealing. He's familiar with a high-profile case in which someone accused of the same was tried and let off with a slap on the wrist. Due to representative bias, he believes he's going to meet the same fate. His lawyer believes that the two cases are entirely incomparable and that the client is actually going to receive 20 years in jail if he goes to trial. Rather than debate the client on the merits, the lawyer wants to show the client a list of cases in which the defendants received harsh sentences. Okay, so she says to herself, I am representing a client who is kidding himself, who thinks that he is going to be released and that it's all going to be fine. I believe that the client is going to get 20 years in jail. So two questions emerge from this. Is she allowed to show the client 10 cases which are like his and resulted in harsh sentences, and to omit 5 cases that are also like his and resulted in light sentences? Could she try to manipulate things by showing him only cases which will support her contention? That's my first question. No. We've got no's around the room. Yeah.
Sounds like a lawyer has a bias.
Well, the lawyer definitely has a bias.
They have their own cognitive bias that they have to deal with. There are 5 cases that are similar and show a lenient sentence. Why shouldn't they pursue, at least technically pursue that path? Or why not?
Okay. Her bias, she's going to argue it's based on her reasoning that's brought her to this and her experience.
There's 5 cases that she's ignoring.
Right.
It's not based on her reasoning. Or it doesn't seem like it's based on her reasoning.
Okay, I will, Jerry, and then... All right, Michael, and then Jerry. Yeah.
Because, you're not the judge. You're here to serve your clients as best as you can. And we all know we have clients who, when you tell them it's day, they say it's night, and it's night, they say it's day, and you can't even lead them to water. They might have them drink it. So, at the end of the day, if things don't go well, you're the one that's going to suffer, and your client's the one that's going to suffer. If that's the way you can get it to see reality, I don't think you're wrong with that.
Sergio or Jerry?
Yeah, I think that your obligation is to present a fair and reasonable assessment of the situation. And, I often have clients ask me, what are the percentages of success in X, Y type of application? And I'm not going to give you any percentages. I can tell you from recent experience, this is more or less what can happen. And this is the worst case scenario, and this is the best case scenario. And there is a range of possibilities in between. So you go and make your own decision. I cannot make the decision for you. I can only present you, the options as
the question is yes or no. Are you going to give them the 5 cases, the 10 and the 5, or are you just going to give them the 10 against them?
I would give them all the cases.
And you would give them all the cases.
That's right.
So I think that's the general view, Michael, notwithstanding.
Of course.
I guess my next question doesn't even begin, except for you. You can answer the next question. What about, would you be allowed to show the client cases that are not like his, but which he's more likely to accept as parallel because of his lack of education and experience? Could you trick him by giving him cases that are not parallel, but he'll think they're parallel?
No,
obviously not at this point.
Right. No sense.
and practically makes no sense. Because that client ends up going into jail and bad-mouthing you and telling everybody that you misled them.
Well, unless you're...
From a business perspective or from an ethical perspective.
Well, the idea would be that you're actually leading him to make what you believe is the decision that's in his best interest. And get him out of jail.
It's one thing if the lawyer doesn't know, then obviously...
No. The lawyer knows, but the lawyer feels like the client is going to make the wrong decision, and by making things up, they'll get him to make the right decision.
Okay, that's representing the facts.
So here, I would hope.
I wouldn't go there.
I would hope we're not getting any agreement on doing this. No. Jeff.
I think it might be counterproductive to show him all the cases. I think what you have to do, more along the lines you were saying, is that you have to say there's a current of cases that stand for this proposition. There's a current of cases that stand for the other proposition. In my view, applying the facts to your situation, because it always turns on the specific facts, this is the most likely result. And then, most importantly, all to protect ourselves, we then send a confirming letter indicating we warned you that X was here. And that, I think, is a real prime, because all of your clients eventually, if it goes south, turn around and said, you guaranteed me that I would win. Right. That's their bias.
Right. One second.
Well, that's, I mean, obviously, with my practice, it's usually about the numbers, and I really hesitated over the 10 cases and the 5 cases, because I can pull out the compendium and give you all the personal injury cases involving tears in knees, and some of them will have very good awards, and some of them will have really pathetic awards. And if the client is biased towards the high side, it's worth it to show them where the low side is and where the number could fall off. And one thing that I always tell them is that I'm never going to tell you a number, because that way the fact that I never say a number means that, you know, anybody who ever asks can be told, nope, Leah never gives a number. Mm-hmm. I'll show you the cases, but I'll tell you the number could be anywhere in this range. And the range goes from zero. It starts at zero.
Gwendolyn, and then...
Depends on the judge and their glucose level.
I think there's another reason to write the letter, and it's not just to cover ourselves. There's a bias out there that written words have more authority than spoken words. Mm-hmm. And so when you put it in writing to your client, it carries that authority.
Okay. That's a point in
itself. It helps organize your own thoughts, too.
Yes, it does. Right, the writing, I think, is an important point. Sergio, and then the hand.
There are a couple of things. Obviously, this is a very complex matter, and we don't have time here, but I think that also depends on what the client is biased about. Because there are things that the client will be biased about, like a certain specific result in a certain type of application that you know for certain. For example, in my practice, which I deal with immigration law, that I send clients to ports of entry or to make different kinds of applications. I know for sure, this is fair with the law. You're not going to succeed. And so, you know, it's kind of like a very certain type of thing. Now, when you are in the realm of... my friend got this and my friend got that, and there is like a range of possibilities, you're much more treacherous ground there. But there are things that if the client insists, no, I know I'm going to succeed in this type of application, and for example, if I want to be an ACTA professional, but I don't have the degree, I says, you're not going to succeed because it's very black and white, this, right? So at which point you have a different situation in which you say, well, I cannot represent you because you're not reasonable on this. You know, but sometimes the client has a bias that is reasonable, because he may say, well, I'm going to fight this particular situation, and he heard that some people have succeeded and other people have not, but he's obviously going to take
so you're suggesting
the ones that help his own bias, right?
So you're suggesting that feeding into the bias of the client may be okay, right, by giving him the information that's going to support it.
Well, depending on circumstances, I don't think you can steer a client either way. I think that I would give a fair and reasonable assessment of the situation. And I would say, in certain cases, you have a pretty good chance, but, you got to be obviously reasonable. Or you have, you are in a situation sometimes.
This is very lawyer like. Raquel.
I think that there is a difference between trying to find information.
Yeah.
Way of shaping things, and it also may be a little risky given some of the other biases we talked about, like confirmation bias, where a client, if you present all the cases, they may totally discount the ones that are relevant to the art office.
Right.
But like using things like framing and loss aversion, I don't think that that doesn't trouble me because, you know, in a lot of things, in certain aspects of that, choice architecture, right? Then there is no simple, right? That's like a pretty universal concept when it comes to the area. I mean, there is the source we didn't discuss, right? Which was the one about insurance policy.
Right.
There has to be a way that you're framing the discussion and talking about something. So if you're talking about it as a loss, you're talking about it as a gain, or a loss versus not getting something new. There's going to be a different attitude, there's going to be a different perception of that.
Yeah.
And there's no neutral. It has to be presented in one of two ways, right?
Right.
You can't present it neutrally.
Right.
It's not the same as withholding information or choosing which information to share. So I think that there's some sort of line between choices like, am I going to share all this information or not, or am I withholding information? And choices like, how am I going to frame the information that's being.
Right. I mean, you have to keep in mind that fundamentally, this is not a lawyer who's trying to hurt the client. This is a lawyer who's trying to help the client. And I think the fact that there are different kinds of biases and different ways to withhold or to present information makes this fuzzier than people's snap response. The calculation for telling the truth and just saying, here is my, you know, vast expanse of knowledge of cases because I searched online and I found all these different cases, the number one, your job is actually not to make the client do what's best for him. Your job is to advise the client, and the client makes up his own mind or her own mind. And the way the rules work, I mentioned it at the outset, are if you believe the client isn't able to make a proper decision, then it's up to the client to get somebody who will represent the client to then make the proper decision. It's not up to you to say, well, I'm going to make the decision for you. That's, I think, an important general principle. The other reason that I found to argue on behalf of just giving the client all the information is because your values and the client's values are different. You know, one of the cases that I gave before, one of the papers that I quoted before, the Ian Weinstein case paper, talked about him counseling a client who had the opportunity to become a witness for the prosecution against other people, and then he could get himself a lighter sentence. And the lawyer is of the belief that that's not actually in the defendant's best. I'm sorry, the lawyer believes that he should take the deal, and the client refuses the deal. Down the line, the client ends up going to jail. He meets him later after the fellow finished his term in jail, and the guy is happy that he did what he did. Because in his value system, not turning on his friends and associates was more important to him than not serving in jail. The values are different. So that matters as well. Sorry, what were you going
to
say?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that for all the lawyers here, just following up on what you just said, that if anyone perceives that a client is under a disability and is not capable of reasoning out their own, coming to a reasonable conclusion on their own, they have an obligation to raise that issue with the judge and with fellow counsel and to possibly bring a motion for a legal representative from the Office of the Public Guardian and Trustee to be appointed.
Right.
And if you don't do that and you get a decision, your decision could be totally nullified at a later date because
right.
the client then is found to have a disability that went unrecognized.
Correct.
So this is a lesser known, it's one of the rules of professional conduct.
Right.
Everyone should really stay on top of that with mentally disordered clients.
Right. And that was what I was going for with the quota number. Which one was it?
Yeah, but
number two.
How do you assess that?
Right. It's not your job to decide. It's your job to raise the question. Okay. The arguments against telling him the truth is that sometimes sometimes he's not competent to make the right decision. Even if he's generally competent, then no one's going to assign him a representative. And the truth of the matter is, unexplained advice is more successful than explanation. Often is. I brought you a source on it in number 25. I'm not going to go through it, but it's there in number 25. People will often listen to the professional and take the professional's word for it because that's what they want. And they don't want the explanation. That's just going to raise doubts. Jerry.
That's the most dangerous thing somebody could do. But come back to him after. And you didn't give me any information. You just said because I said it.
Understood, but it's the way people work.
But you're any lawyer or any investment advisor that's
Jerry, when you go to the when you bring your car into the mechanic, right? Do you want the mechanic to give you all the different reasons why he believes you should replace that valve, or you just go to him and say, "Tell me what needs to be done and do it"?
Can I just say
they're not.
That's your life.
The same bodies that govern us that will not accept that.
Yeah, I'm going to move forward with this just because it's getting late and my voice is going. In the secular system, it seems very clear that the lawyer has to divulge all the information. If you take a look at number 26, where I brought you the commentary to the rules, a lawyer should clearly specify the facts, circumstances, and assumptions on which an opinion is based, particularly when the circumstances do not justify an exhaustive investigation, the resultant expense to the client. However, unless the client instructs otherwise, what is effective communication will vary depending on the nature of the retainer, the needs, sophistication of the client. A lawyer should be wary of bold and overconfident assurances to the client. The basic principle is that you have to be forthright. And I think a lot of this reflects what has happened in medicine. The same system has come into play that you have to be forthright with the patient. Going back to Hippocrates, the principle was the doctor is the one who knows what's best, and the patient should listen to the doctor. And the doctor should not explain medical advice to the patient, but should simply prescribe. And if the patient has a terminal diagnosis, the doctor should never tell the patient. At most, if there's some need for the patient to know, the doctor should tell a friend of the patient, and the friend should have some way to inform the patient of the seriousness of the situation. I kid you not. Hippocrates wrote it out. It comes up in Jewish law as well, but I'm not going to go into that right now. If you look at number 27, the original code of ethics of the Canadian Medical Association, physicians should unite tenderness with firmness, condescension with authority, and thus inspire their patients with gratitude, respect, and confidence. The obedience of a patient to the prescriptions of his physician should be prompt and implicit. He should never permit his own crude opinions as to their fitness to influence his attention to them. And so on. You listen to your doctor, and you do exactly what the doctor tells you. What changed? Lawyers. Lawyers were what changed it. And I'm not kidding. Look at number 28. While physicians did develop a more consistent practice of obtaining patient consent in the early 20th century, the medical literature indicates the practice was fueled more by a desire to respond to lawsuits than by a moral imperative to respect patient autonomy. It was because of fear that things go south, you get blamed. The idea of client dignity, of patient dignity and autonomy, only emerges as a modern concept after the fact. And I brought you a number 29, the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, where they frame it in terms of autonomy, personal dignity of the patient, and therefore the patient gets to make the decision. Within the practice of law, I think it is basically the same set of concerns. If I don't give him all the information, he has grounds to attack me later on. And out of respect for the client, I should give him the information. However, paper after paper that I've read on this, and the lawyers who I talked to off the record, have told me that nonetheless, they will sometimes structure their presentation to the client in order to produce what they believe is a result that's in the client's best interest. I gave you just a couple of examples on the sheet. I'm skipping the one in number 30, where he talks about using the heuristic, using the bias to to influence the client. But take a look at number 31, which is another example of this. Kropkin and Guthrie argue that there are two different ways in which attorneys can work to reduce psychological barriers to the settlement of lawsuits. First, they can attempt to negotiate in a manner that prevents the barriers from being constructed in the first place. In other words, avoid the bias. Second, because it is highly unlikely that attorneys will successfully avoid all psychological barriers, attorneys can work to minimize the effect of already erected barriers on settlement behavior. For example, because people generally are risk-averse when choosing between options framed as gains, but risk-seeking when choosing between options framed as losses, and have a stronger reaction to losses than to gains, an attorney representing a defendant may reframe the litigation for the client to help the client perceive settlement opportunities as gains rather than losses. Exactly what Raquel had mentioned before. According to this, the idea of using framing, which is clearly not as bad as hiding cases, but the idea of using framing is supported. There is the possibility of saying, this is actually in the client's best interest, and therefore I'm able to work on the client's behalf using the bias in order to support my case. There are cases where they will, where lawyers will do it. Corporate lawyers influencing the way a corporation functions. There are many more sources that I could bring to support this. Reed.
I think this whole thing with the bias and the is under a macro concept that we're discussing here of flawed foundational assumptions. So when your flawed foundational assumptions are incorrect at any level, and so that's why you say you're doing a superficial look at it or a real in-depth look at it. So I just think that the concept here we're discussing is your foundational assumption.
Right.
Okay. So that's not your bias is off.
Can be with that. It doesn't have to be, but it can be.
It doesn't have to be. I think they do have to.
Within Jewish law, the approach is actually different. Meaning, within the secular framework, what we're saying is the law wants you to be honest with your client, even though there are cases where lawyers do use the framing bias and other biases on behalf of their case. Jewish law, when it comes to medicine, tends to be very paternalistic and to say the doctor is working on behalf of the patient in his best interest, and therefore the doctor is entitled to say whatever she thinks is best for the patient. So, for example, the classic example, it's Yom Kippur. Patient says, I want to fast. It's Yom Kippur, most important fast, I have to fast. The doctor says, you are not able to fast. The rabbis are responsible to listen to the doctor and say to the patient, you must eat. The doctor is able to say, and the rabbi is able to say, whatever they need to say in order to get the patient to eat. That's the basic principle. So that from this standpoint, it sounds like what we are saying is that the lawyer would be able to establish whatever needs to be said in order to influence the client. However, I don't think that it's quite analogous. And the reason it's not analogous is because the logic in the case of medicine is that the patient is not free to destroy his or her own life. From a Jewish law perspective, you're not allowed to surrender your life to somebody else. And if the doctor has the knowledge necessary to preserve my life, then the doctor is certainly free to use that in order to get me to say to preserve my health. I'm not going into the whole assisted suicide legislation. That's a whole other can of worms. You think we need 90 minutes for this? We need way more than that for that. However, decisions of law are largely about managing the client's property and personal freedom. And a person who wants to pay for losing a trial, a person who wants to make a bad settlement, a person who wants to put herself into jail, is free to do so in Jewish law. That's their right. And therefore, you won't have the same paternalistic approach in dealing with a client as you will in dealing with a patient. So again, what I'm trying to say is that from a Jewish law perspective, there may be cases where a doctor feels the patient is going to make a decision that is terrible for her health, and that concealing information, now I'm not getting into also the question of whether you can lose your license to practice medicine this way. There's a whole other, I'm not prescribing for the doctors right now. But there is a potential imperative of save the patient's life at the expense of the patient's autonomy. You won't necessarily find the same thing in law, because the patient, the client, is entitled to decide, I want to spend more. That's my decision. I want to go to jail. That's my decision. It's more important to me that this happen. And therefore, the lawyer isn't entitled to decide what are the patient's best interests. Yes?
I was just wondering, do you think finances don't tie into health? Like, if your client's about to lose $200,000 and you think that's not going to allow them to provide a quality of life for themselves or their family.
You're correct. I'm drawing too neat a line between finances and health. Going to jail also, you know, may have an impact on one's health. This is true. Nonetheless, as long as the result is indirect, I will have less of a concern for that impact. Last question. Are you allowed to take advantage of bias in pitching a settlement or arguing before a jury? Could you use priming numbers, right, like we talked about before with the Social Security numbers, on a jury? Could you deliberately make sure that food is not provided for the negotiators sitting at the table so they're more likely to use System 1 thinking and approach the problem superficially? What would you say?
No.
I'm hearing no's, Jerry.
In an advocacy situation, the other guy can do it too.
The other guy can do it too. Okay. The truth of the matter is that the secular system is unclear in what it will allow. We already saw the rule from chapter 5 that I brought above, that you have to treat the tribunal with candor, fairness, courtesy, and respect. Presumably, that should militate against trying to get people to do things that are not in their best interest by tricking them, right? I would have thought so, despite the commentary there, which talks about being aggressive and so forth. Take a look, though, at source number 33. From the negotiator as professional, these people who wrote this article are not happy people. As Wiggins and Lowry have argued, there is a clear potential for conflict between the attorney's own values and the perceived duty of single-minded, zealous advocacy on behalf of the client's interests. Shockingly, this impoverished state of affairs that results in a confounding of the boundary of professional responsibility and negotiation ethics apparently makes it difficult to make prescriptive statements about truth-telling and lawyers. That was such a lawyerly way of saying that. These acknowledgments amount, in my view, to a remarkably sad state of affairs. If lawyers cannot be counted on or at least mandated to tell the truth, who can? What we are left with then is a relatively barren ethical terrain that leaves the representative negotiator without adequate guidance for ethical negotiation. Current practices encourage Gross and Siverud, for example, to ask questions such as, under what circumstances should a party make a sincere offer, an outrageous demand, an insincere threat to go to trial? Further, for example, Norton comments that the concept of truthfulness in negotiation raises unique ethical questions because in most circumstances, candor is not necessarily required. Silver articulates that representative lawyers, quote, can be misleading, can bluff, and can threaten action at will. Further, Bouye and Kelly argue that even for lawyers governed by professional codes of conduct, in negotiation, exaggeration and sheer puffery are tolerated.
Absolutely.
As such, Wiggins and Lowry question whether, quote, the profession should attempt to police lying in negotiation at all. The ethically questionable state of affairs in representative negotiation should not be tolerated, particularly for representative negotiators who are also members of the bar and subject to professional obligations. They're not happy, as I said. The truth of the matter is that we require candor and honor, but it's very vague. And I think that there is reason to ask the question about which biases will be considered a violation of that and which biases will not. The halachic system is more pragmatic. And it states simply that bias is normal, and it's always going to play a role in the judicial process. And here I come back to the question that was asked before about the judge in the Jewish system, because keeping in mind that the classic Beit Din system, the rabbinical court, does not have a lawyer for either side, The litigants themselves argue the case in front of the judge. The witnesses testify before the judge, and the judge cross-examines. There have always been people who came to help out on either side, who were effectively functioning as lawyers. But the question now is, are you entitled to try to bias the judge? Based on what we've said so far, and this is where the Jewish law perspective comes into play, it seems like you can't not try to bias the judge.
Exactly.
Meaning that there are so many different ways in which people are influenced in their decision making. You put someone in a good mood, you bias them. They like you, you bias them. They eat food that maybe you brought to the court, you held the door. There are so many different ways that you can bias people. The reality is that bias is always going to play a role in the judicial process. You know, the Talmud has a statement, if you take a look at source number 34, talking about how voting goes among judges in capital cases. The way that things work in a capital case, it says, the judges begin to vote from the side. And what that means is that you don't start your voting with the judge who's considered most senior and most scholarly. You start with a judge who's lower down in the hierarchy out of concern that otherwise this judge who voted first, who's known to be the greatest among them, is going to bias the rest. That's a very old principle. We try to avoid that kind of a bias. However, we don't have a sealed ballot in which we say that all the judges are required to write down their votes and therefore no one will bias the other. In other words, every judge who votes after number one has heard somebody else's view. There isn't an attempt to eliminate all bias. That's not there. Another example, we said that we don't accept a friend or an enemy as a judge. However, take a look at number 35 from the Code of Jewish Law. We do accept a friend or an enemy to serve as a witness in a trial. And we just work with the idea that they're supposed to be reporting what they saw, even though we know that people's biases influence what they think they saw. Why is this? Why is the Jewish system allowing the friend or the enemy to serve as a witness? Why is it that we don't say the judges should make sure that there's no bias whatsoever in their voting? The answer, I think, is we need a workable system. It's a concession to reality. And in the end, the Jewish system leaves it to the judge to do the best possible to weed out bias and then move on. If you take a look at source number 36, Rabbi Moses Maimonides wrote in his Laws of Testimony and Disqualification of Witnesses, he says, these matters depend only upon the judge's mind and his great comprehension to understand the essence of the relevant laws and to know what leads to other things and to examine deeply. If he sees that this witness has some way to benefit from this testimony, even distantly and remarkably, he shall not testify in the matter. In other words, the judge has to make the analysis of what's acceptable and not acceptable and go on that basis. But fundamentally, it's recognized that bias is built into any system involving human beings. Is this clear? I sped up a little bit, but the secular system is unclear in what it will allow, and the Jewish law system, I think, is saying, realistically, you can't eliminate it all. However, we do draw one line, and the line that we draw is to prohibit intentional deception, where an act is entered into specifically in order to try to lead somebody to make a bad conclusion, that's where we draw the line. Take a look at number 39, please. Number 39. If one sells a cow and says, this cow gores, bites, kicks, and sprawls. So you identify how many different defects? Four different defects. Gores, bites, kicks, and sprawls. It only has one of those defects, which he included among these defects. That is grounds for claiming it was an erroneous purchase. Right? Because what did I do? I told him about four problems. He tests for one. He sees that's not there. And he thinks to himself, this is a hypersensitive seller. He's just protecting himself. And none of these defects are there. So I tricked him. That's no good, and it's grounds for reversing a sale. the delusion was real and it was intentional. But then you keep on reading. If he names this defect and one other, the seller only named two possible defects, one of which is real. It is not an erroneous purchase. You can, at that point, the buyer cannot back down, cannot back out of the deal. Even though it's inappropriate to delude people in this way, this is still not a purchase from which he can back out. Why can't he back out from this purchase?
I guess it's because he could have tested it more easily.
Because he could have tested it more easily, and because it's standard. Because there's such a thing as standard operating procedure. There are certain things that people normally do in the course of a negotiation, in the course of a business transaction, and if it's considered the norm, then one is allowed to engage in it. I gave you a source of number 40, but I'll state it outside of the text. From Dr. Aaron Levine. He's talking about a union negotiation between a university and the professors, and how sitting down at the table, one side, the representative of one side, says to the other side, how is your wife doing? How are your kids doing? Expressing concern for how his family is. Everybody knows intellectually that this is being done in order to create a certain type of friendly atmosphere where there has been none. And everybody knows that the person who's doing this, who's making this opening, creating the atmosphere, is trying to establish an air which will cause his arguments to be more accepted by the other side. Is it inappropriate for him to do so? No. Why not? Because it's standard operating procedure. And therefore, everybody is aware of what's going on, and therefore it's... And therefore we're good with it. I think that as long as you stay within what is considered the norm, and you don't have intention to deceive, like active, like I want to go out and trick somebody, I think from a Jewish law perspective, you're safe. Naming numbers, right, saying 49 in order to get him to subliminally accept that 49,000 would be a good number for the settlement, I think that's over the line. I think that's already over the line. But the issue of framing something as a gain versus a loss, or vice versa, I think is more in play. All right. I hope that I made things clear. My cold is a little bit debilitating here, but I hope that that it worked. I'm sticking around to answer questions. Please make sure you signed in, especially if you want credit, and also if you want notification about future classes. Where are the sign-in sheets? There's one here, and there's one here. Thank you very much.